you. We'll call Mr. Colgrave now, who you can see there on screen. And I think is thankfully feeling much better today than he has been. So.
Yes, he is looking very perky.
The relative concept.
Yes. Resume the hearing. We have Mr. Colgrave giving evidence for Corbridge Estates. Mr. Colgrave, how would you like to proceed?
I haven't prepared a summary, but I'm happy to talk to anything that's in my evidence if you like. Otherwise, we can go to questions if that works for you, sir.
We've all read your evidence. I think some of it seems remarkably familiar. Which
yes.
will aid the process. That's so. We will. I think we will just go to questions. And the I'm going to put a line through previous questions because I've already asked them to you. I want to talk about how, in practice, the response to COVID is going to play out. When almost contemporaneously with reading your evidence, I was reading a newspaper coverage from that esteemed organisation, the Otago Daily Times, telling me that a boutique hotel project in Wanaka that was shovel ready had been put on hold, and I wondered the extent to which that is the practical reality that you said we can and should plan, but is anything actually going to happen anytime soon in terms of these large-scale tourism-related developments?
I think people who are further down the track and who are, you know, about to sort of turn soil, if you like, might be thinking about the environment that their development would be launching into in a year or two's time. So I think people who are at that stage of the development process might be a little more wary of those short-term effects of the virus than those like ourselves at Corbridge who, you know, they're a few years further down the track in terms of, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of consenting design, all that sort of stuff. So I think the fact that developments that are still at this stage, you know, they're realistically probably 4 to 5 years away from inviting their first guests through the gate, I think they're probably taking a slightly different outlook and they'd have the benefit of being much further up the recovery curve than those who were, you know, say, hoping to be open in 2021, 2022. So I think that's probably the distinction.
Commissioner Dawson.
Have you factored in any long-term costs of locating, particularly the residential components, but also the tourists and the hotel component, away from the town centre? Wanaka?
I haven't explicitly modelled that in terms of costs. I guess there's two sides to it. The first, I guess, is that there's potentially some transport costs for people who stay at the resort and who want to go into the town centre, which I imagine would happen reasonably frequently. So that there's probably some transport costs there. I guess the offset is that, you know, rather than having that development in and around the town centre per se, perhaps there's less sort of congestion on a day-to-day basis in terms of those people coming in and out. So it's a bit of a trade-off, but I haven't really gone into any more detailed analysis of those effects. I guess the comparison is Queenstown, where, you know, the bulk of the accommodation is directly in and around the town centre, and it's arguably one of the really drivers of the congestion issues that they have there. So in some ways, I think it's a benefit to not have it too close to the town centre in that respect.
And does that apply to the residential component as well as the visitors?
I don't believe there's a huge permanent residential component. So, but I suppose for those people, again, the comparison is if they weren't to stay at that location, where would they stay, and would that location be more or less remote than this relative to the town centre? And I think the other thing with the residential part is that I would imagine a lot of those people would probably meet their day-to-day shopping needs at Three Parks as opposed to the town centre, particularly once Three Parks becomes more developed and has a greater offering. So the distance from the subject site to Three Parks is quite short, so perhaps the implications aren't too bad for those people.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Hill.
No, I have nothing additional, thank you.
I totally accept and understand the discussion that you've got about hotel requirement in Wanaka Upper Clutha. Is, in your opinion, the concept of if you build one, we'll get three, like if you build McDonald's builds next to KFC, is this a game changer for Wanaka?
I think in some ways it is. The commercial accommodation offer in Wanaka is obviously much less than over the hill in Queenstown, and it may be that this is the sort of facility that people who want to stay in Wanaka but haven't made the trip yet are looking for. The fresh info report that sits behind my analysis makes the point quite strongly that there is quite often supply-led demand in tourism. So when a brand new facility with all these sort of things is provided to the market, it definitely stimulates demand that just wasn't there otherwise. And I'm not saying that supply by itself will create its own demand, but there's certainly elements of that. It's a significant boost in Wanaka's long-term commercial accommodation capacity. And there certainly are people who prefer to stay at a hotel over any other type of accommodation sort of type. So you know, there'll certainly be a market there that'll be attracted to Wanaka by this facility for sure.
And also just interested in, you touched on tourist accommodation spending in Wanaka as a proportion is almost twice as high as the national average. Can you tease that out for me a wee bit, please? As to why?
I think that's covered in the fresh info report. There's two elements there. One is potentially that they stay longer, so they have a longer average length of stay per trip, or they're spending more per day. I don't have access to that breakdown at my fingertips, but I think it's a bit of both. And I think quite a few people who stay at Wanaka and ski at Cardrona and so on would be staying for quite long periods of time. So I think it's a mix of slightly longer length of stay and slightly higher spend per day. But I also understand that the demographic that's attracted to Wanaka tends to be slightly older than the demographic attracted to Queenstown on average. Obviously, there's big overlaps there. But I think my understanding is there's a slightly more mature market that's attracted to Wanaka, and they tend to spend quite a bit more per day as well.
So can I take it from that we should be charging them more?
If they're willing to pay it, sure.
No further questions here.
Mr. Colgrave, I have two final questions. Looking at your table five, impacts of construction at full build.
Yes.
Is the direct GDP figure, does that equal the actual build cost, or is it something different?
No, it's not. So the GDP is really sort of the value that's provided over and above the cost of the materials used. So if I build something that I sell for $100, but I spent $50 on materials, then the GDP is the $100 is the value of what I provided less the value of the material, so it's $50. So the GDP in this table is sort of the value they provide by taking a set of inputs and working with them to create a different output. So it can also be described as the total sum of the wages and profits and taxes that are made during the construction process.
So I've just written down, to get a total build cost, you'd have to add the building material, construction materials.
Yeah, that's right. So it's the value of the output minus the value of the materials used in the process.
Can you tell me what the total build cost is?
No, I don't have that in these tables. It would be significantly higher than the values in the table, though. So as a rule of thumb, GDP is often about 30 or 40% of output. So if we've got, for instance, say $200 million GDP, that might come from a $500 to $600 million build.
And the other thing, since I'm a golfer, this intrigued me. You've got a calculation of impacts of golf course operation. What green fees did you assume in arriving at those that calculation?
I'd have to look them up in the spreadsheet. We benchmarked them against other marquee courses, so off the top of my head would probably be in the 100 to 150 range, but I'd have to check it.
Can I leave that with you to come back on an exceptions basis? If having checked it's something different, you come back, but otherwise, via Ms. Irving, but otherwise I'll assume that that's your final answer.
Sure, happy to do that.
Thank you very much. One more question?
Sorry, who would have thought? Table 8 of your evidence, it talked about the current floor space in the Wanaka Town Centre by land use type. I noticed there was no cafe restaurant in there. Is that is it included somewhere else?
Yeah, so those are the land use types that are defined by CoreLogic and their data set. I believe it probably falls under retail.
There you go, that makes sense. Thank you.
That's it. Thanks, Mr. Colgrove.
Thank
you for your time.
And, thanks very much.
Thank you, Fraser. All right, so we will next move on to Mr. Smith, dealing with the acoustic issues.
Good afternoon. I've got a few observations from the rebuttal evidence of Dr. Charles to the council, and also a few follow-ups from questions I've already had this morning, so hopefully that will streamline your line of questioning. In my evidence, I reviewed the 2018 noise contours for Wanaka Airport, and Dr. Charles considered that these contours were irrelevant. I agree that the outer control boundary should be used for determining land use compatibility. However, reviewing the existing contours for context provides a comparison to observations on site. Dr. Charles considers that it's reasonable to locate recreational activities near airports. However, he states that having such areas within the outer control boundary is a compromised location for those activities. His experience with Jack's Point is that some people find aircraft sound to cause considerable disturbance on the golf course. In Mr. Lane's evidence and presentation this morning, he set out a number of successful golf courses near major airports. I agree with the questions from the panel that at least the overseas examples are significantly more urban and a direct comparison is not necessarily appropriate. I do believe, however, that Clearwater Resort in Christchurch is an appropriate comparison, nestled within the Waimakariri River Corridor. The nearest residential zones are approximately 1 kilometre away. It is both rural and a marquee golf course. Another relevant example is Jack's Point. Wanaka Airport will not be of the same scale to the airports in the examples provided by Mr. Lane. while jets of an A320 size may operate out of Wanaka Airport in relatively small numbers, the projections are still for the majority of movements being from general aviation. In conclusion, I agree with Dr. Charles that some individuals may find aircraft noise an unwanted distraction, but overall it is reasonable to locate such recreational activities within the outer control boundary. The majority of the Corbridge development is intentionally outside the outer control boundary, including all visitor and work accommodation, as well as the clubhouses. And I'm happy to take questions.
Just to clarify, writing down and not writing fast enough, you said the majority of Corbridge development is outside the OCB.
Correct.
Including
visitor and worker accommodation and the clubhouses.
All the VA and all the residential houses, you said?
Yeah. Work accommodation.
It is the OCB that's shown on the maps and that you're using.
Correct.
Irrespective of what Mr. Charles's concerns were, you have used that.
Correct.
And when you say the majority of the development is outside the OCB, what is the minority that is within it?
There's approximately two of the holes. So it is purely the golf course and open space areas. There's no development in terms of structures within the OCB. It's really just the couple of northernmost fairways adjacent to the river.
Paragraph 21, you compare the noise from a Cessna or a Piper overhead, 1,000 foot overhead. It's not currently the position. What would an A320 over the top of you generate?
Obviously, a jet would be somewhat louder. I don't know. It's the flip side is it will be present for significantly less time. I'd say it's probably in the 65 to 70 decibel sort of range, depending again whether it's directly overhead or offset. And also, the A320 will be climbing at a higher rate than your general aviation type aircraft. So yeah, there's a number of factors, including the actual flight paths and.
What's the prevailing wind? Is it from Wanaka towards the airport or the reverse?
I asked the QAC for some stats on the movement data, which would include that direction, but they declined to provide it, so I'm not sure what the split of actual movements are. But you'll see in my evidence that Annex A shows what the preferred flight paths are, and they essentially fly over the Clutha at the northern end of the site and then continue on before they commence their turn either to the Catrona Valley or continue out to Lake Wanaka. So there should be no turning movements over the Corbridge site, or just be flying direct along the extended centre line. And with any commercial operations, there'll be a greater level of certainty of where they're actually going, as the pilots are somewhat more professional.
Looking at your paragraph 32, just to clarify, is my understanding correct? L day is the average noise over a 24-hour period?
No, that'll be the daytime period. So not a 24-hour LEQ. It'll be between LEQ. 7
during daylight hours. The average noise over daylight hours. Yeah. We know an average covers a multitude of sins, and acoustic experts, in my experience, are very familiar with the differences or the ability of instantaneous noise to skew averages. To me, an average over daylight hours is not a particularly helpful reference point. Like, I understand you're referring to studies, and therefore you take what you can get by definition. But if you were looking, you know, for disturbance to visitors, is there a more useful statistic, noise statistic, that you could give us? That
I think the best way of looking at what the noise effects will be, so you visited the site and you will have observed the light aircraft flying over. So the sound level from general aviation, individual aircraft, is not going to change. That's largely going to be one plane flying over in 20 years' time. That will still be that one plane flying over. There may be more of them, so you can consider what the frequency of events may increase with increased volume, but for those smaller aircraft, the individual sound levels will be relatively unchanged. And then that will just be supplemented with a small number, or a proportionally small number of large aircraft movements. So I agree that these combination, the noise limits and noise descriptors, are born out of necessity, but they never fully describe the situation. So having directly observed what those sound levels are on the site yourselves, you can just imagine if they were more frequent but of the same level, rather than trying to come up with an average, if that makes any sense.
Thank you. Commissioner Hill, do you have anything for Mr.
No,
Smith?
I have nothing. Thank you.
Mr. Dawson?
No, it's all fine. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's Dawson. Three no's. Thanks very much.
Well, on that note, thank you very much for your input, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Appreciate the questions.
All right. In. Call Mr. Eastby.
How many times is this?
I've lost count
long
ago.
I think you might get the prize.
Got a few more to come yet.
I do observe that you're looking very corporate today.
That's correct, yes. Yes, thank you. Thank you for noticing.
Casual pass-by visits.
So I've handed around a summary there, Commissioners, which is less than 2 pages, but I've attached some plans for your convenience.
It's a technique that's commonly used.
Yes. So I'll read that out, Commissioners, because it's a bit of an update.
Thank you.
And then go from there. All right, so the proposed Corbridge Rural Visitor Zone is not within an ONL. It is in rural farmland between Wanaka Airport and Wanaka Albert Town. By definition, non-ONL landscapes are less sensitive than ONL landscapes. The proposed relief uses a structure plan that has been formulated based on landscape sensitivity in order to configure development. The result is that denser development is concentrated in the central, topographically hidden part of the site, and the more exposed and sensitive parts of the site are kept in an undeveloped rural state. Since preparing my evidence, the relief sought has been amended in that an area of moderate high landscape sensitivity is now proposed in addition to the area of high landscape sensitivity. This is reflected on the plans attached to the summary. The identification of the moderate high landscape sensitivity area has come from the evidence of Mr. Matthew Jones and has been adopted by the submitter. I've confirmed with Mr. Jones via email that his area has been correctly identified in the plans. So if we just quickly go to the plans, commissioners, the first one is perhaps the clearest one, which is the areas of landscape sensitivity. So the red hatch is high landscape sensitivity that had been previously identified, and that really consists of the area of broad rolling open paddocks that are displayed to the highway, and then also at the northern end of the site, the escarpment that is displayed to the north, but also quite a strip of the flat land, which is the lip of the escarpment, if you like.
And was that, is that the northern one the same as was in your original
yes,
evidence?
Yes, those two haven't changed. Mm-hmm. Then we've got the blue hatch, which is the area of moderate high landscape sensitivity, which has come from Mr. Jones, and it takes in the western corner of the site that isn't already high sensitivity, and then also an area north of the high sensitivity but still relatively close to the highway between the two shelter belts, and then curling around on the north side of what is the lake, there are some south-facing slopes there, and he's included those in the moderate high landscape sensitivity. So if we flick over to the next plan is just the same hatches again, superimposed on top of the structure plan. And so that just shows the areas I've been talking about in relation to the structure plan. So the real consequence that we probably need to take account of is that the blue hatched area covers an area of activity area 2, which is close to the south end of the site, and it includes also a bit of the fairway visitor accommodation over at the western side of the site. So those areas are inside the moderate high landscape sensitivity area, so therefore would be subject to a discretionary consent. And the provisions that are attached to those areas we can hear more about from the planners, commissioners, but that's my brief description of it. So if we go back to my paragraph 4, it is also relevant that the proposed provisions, as set out in the planning evidence, include specific maximum building coverages and densities in relation to each activity area. I consider that these provisions and the inclusion of the moderate high landscape sensitivity area addresses the residual concerns of Mr. Jones as set out in those paragraphs of his there that I list. It is my understanding, in my understanding, development that breaches the density or building coverage provisions will be non-complying activity, and any development within the moderate high landscape sensitivity area would be discretionary. In relation to landscape character, I consider that the proposed relief will not significantly endanger the rural character of the landscape within which the site sits. Nodes of visitor activity can sit comfortably within rural landscapes, as is agreed by Mr. Jones. The subject site itself is more able to absorb a node of visitor activity than most settings within the rural landscapes, because it's not within an ONL, it's large and topographically varied enough that an outwardly open green rural character is maintained via the use of the structure plan approach. So that's to do with its size and topography. It's in a location adjacent to a state highway, airport, and area of rural living land use, such that some non-rural or semi-rural activity will be less incongruous than in most rural locations. And the rural visitor activity that would be enabled has been specifically configured via the structure plan and the sensitivity plan, such that development is confined to the specific parts of the site where it will have least effect on both landscape character and visual amenity. Mr. Jones raised some concerns regarding landscape character effects in relation to parts of activity areas 1, 2 and 3 that are in the western and southern reaches of the site, and recommended some additional provisions be applied to those. Development within these areas will now be fully discretionary and subject to the density and coverage provisions that have been mentioned. In relation to visual effects, Mr. Jones and I are in agreement that in relation to visual amenity, the structure plan, and this is from Mr. Jones's evidence, commissioners, the structure plan has located future development into the parts of the site that are for the most part visually contained and discreet. This is predominantly within the central lower parts of the site, adjacent to the lake, such that existing topography and vegetation will largely screen and confine any views to this area from public viewpoints. The southern and northern parts of the site will also largely remain free of built form with open space buffers to the respective boundaries. However, again, Mr. Jones raised issues regarding the effects of the western and southern reaches of activities areas 1, 2, 3 regarding visual effects and recommended some additional mechanisms. Development in these areas will now be fully discretionary in relation to the amended relief. So regarding visual effects, I consider that the proposed structure plan has been formulated such that the visually exposed parts of the site will be free of built development. Some specific provisions relate to the open space road buffer activity area in order to maintain a rural character as experienced by highway users. Council controls and discretion at the time of subdivision or development, especially in relation to the moderate high landscape sensitivity area, will allow specific landscape design to be considered such that it can be used to further mitigate potential visual effects. Overall, I consider that the visual effects will be very well mitigated. So the details of the relief that is sought and the specifics of the site itself will mean that the sensitive parts of the site will not be affected and will be more protected than under the rural zone. The structure plan approach will mean that the development that is enabled will be inconspicuous and not out of place or offensive in its context. Thank you, Commissioners.
Mr. Espy, I'm going to ask you about the general approach to RCLs. I haven't gone back and checked the revised provisions that have come out of the court, but you framed your assessment of maintenance of rural character in terms of the landscape as a whole. If the focus were to be on the site, would your view change? Is the rural character of the site being maintained?
Well, I haven't gone back myself and looked at the wording of those provisions, but
I'm going to ask Mr. Edgar that question. So to take as a working premise that may be a relevant question, it may not too, but I'm interested in your landscape opinion.
Yes. Well, I would say the character of the site itself will change, particularly parts of the site itself. To be more specific, the parts of the site that are not preserved as open space. And I think that's really the case with any of the proposed rural visitor zones. Within the individual sites, a character is going to be experienced that is a rural visitor character, is probably the best way of saying it. It involves a number of buildings, sometimes a lot of buildings, sometimes a dense clump of buildings. So, yes, the site itself will change in character, but the landscape within which it sits, I say, will have its landscape character maintained, and as will parts of the site, the important parts of the site that are important to the broader character, if you like.
And if, again, to change the hypothetical, if the focus were on, you know, the site as a whole, if you're taking... One of the things about this site is that I don't think there'd be any one viewing point unless it was from a helicopter. But suspending disbelief to that extent, you know, what's your view about the effect on the site as a whole, on the rural character of the site as a whole?
As I say, if the relief goes ahead and is fully developed, which might of course take decades, but if we envisage that, then the character of the site will certainly change from what it is now. And in the various ways you could describe the character that would result, I don't think you'd describe it as an urban character. Maybe a resort character is a good way of describing it, or just a rural visitor character. I think you'd experience the character of being in a designed and carefully configured development within a rural setting. You'd have rural amenities all around you, and you'd be within this setting that is a resort type of setting, for want of a better term.
And I think that from your answer to my previous question, I could probably guess what you would say, but if the issue were in fact whether any part of the site, a rural character of the site would change, if that was in fact relevant, then would it ever be possible to get an RV site off the ground, or indeed a rural residential or a rural lifestyle? It's sort of, if you're going to look at that end of the telescope, and narrowly at the developed areas, are you ever going to be able to do anything?
Well, yes, the answer probably is no. You won't be able to develop a zone, whether it's a rural living zone or a rural visitor zone or any other type of zone, you won't be able to develop a zone without changing its character of the site itself.
Site visits didn't extend to going up Mount Iron, but I recall doing that for previous sections. It'd be a long way away, but how much of the site could you see from Mount Iron vantage points?
I have analysed that somewhere, sir.
That's impressive, yes.
It might be in a report that I wrote at the time of the submission rather than my evidence. But yes, I have examined that. It's a very distant view from the top of Mount Iron, and of course you're looking over the Cardrona River to it, and the land on the far side of the Cardrona River towards the airport you're looking at very obliquely, and there are a number of shelter belts and what have you. I mean, I'd imagine if you stood on top of Mount Iron and deliberately looked at this site, you would be able to see that some changes happened on it, but if you weren't deliberately looking for it, it would be a very minor part of a huge panorama.
Yes, I understand. Yes, that's the ultimate 360 degree view. Commissioner Hill.
Just clarify, I don't think we'll go, I won't go, I mean Commissioner Dawson might go down the questions that we've been asking before about remote, and wait until we've had that discussion. just tell me, in terms of dealing with the landscape analysis, just tell me how it actually works. So you go out and have a look at the site and make your evaluation based on the values. But do you have regard to what the plan provisions are attempting to achieve?
Yes. I'd say if I go out and if some landowner asked me to go out and report back on his site and how that sits in relation to landscape sensitivity and what have you, yeah, I certainly, if I'm doing it in this district, I certainly have in my mind the objectives and policies and so on to do with the different landscape categories, and that forms part of my opinion and advice, yes.
Right. So in terms of the, I mean, hence the way that this zone was notified, which was very restrictive, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but presumably you would have to look at this zoning and the landscape assessment quite differently than, as Ms Grace has recommended, broadening it out, but also Mr Edgar's suggested plan provisions, which are attempting to take away then those terms of remoteness and hasn't taken away limited scale, but sort of has clearly broadened it out. So your assessment is clearly in that context.
Yes, although I would say if I'm asked to go and look at a site like this and give advice about what I think it could absorb by way of some formulated zoning, I'm not thinking too much about the provisions of that particular formulated zoning. I'm thinking more about how that site fits into the strategic objectives and policies of the district plan and the landscapes of the district as a whole in relation to landscape categories and the related objectives and policies. So I suppose my initial reporting back would be about what sort of capacity I think the site has to absorb certain types of development and maybe what parts of the site, but I wouldn't be too swayed at that point by, you know, the provisions of the notified zone, say.
Right. And I think that's your clear evidence. I mean, your evidence is that certainly parts of the site can absorb that development.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Dawson.
So just following on from that, but you wouldn't then either be asked to or offer a view on the particular provisions for the zone that's proposed, like whether it's a rural living zone or a resort zone, or in this case the rural visitor zone, which is the next level of objectives and policies, I guess.
Well, I probably wouldn't be asked too much about that in the first instance, but then working past those initial stages and working towards, let's say, supporting a submission or preparing evidence for something like this, I would consult with the planners involved a lot to ensure that whatever mechanisms they formulate fit with my idea of what can be absorbed.
Yes, but at that higher strategic objectives and policies level rather than the particulars that the zone's seeking.
Oh, well, also down to the particulars, I guess. I mean, I would, you know, I would check with them what is provided for in each activity area and sort of check with my own opinions whether I think that's suitable or not, and if I think it's not, I'd report that back. So I guess, I mean, I don't formulate the provisions that the zone ends up having in it, but I critically examine them from a landscape perspective, I suppose, to make sure that I'm comfortable.
But say the zone said something like, provide for development of limited intensity and scale, or in the rural lifestyle ones, they talk about built form being compatible with low density residential built form. You know, that's the sort of next level down of policy. But do you examine that as a landscape advisor, or are you really usually tend to go back to those chapter 3, chapter 6 type policies?
Yeah, I suppose you're correct, yes. Once we get down to a certain level of planning mechanism, yes, it's no longer so relevant to me, and so I don't comment on it, I suppose. I would describe to the planners, here's the sort of result that I think is appropriate in terms of the higher order objectives and policies, and leave it to them to figure out the mechanisms to bring that about and the descriptive words that end up going in the actual provisions, such as limited scale or something like that.
Right, and for them to choose what zone might work best for whatever it is they think.
Yes, that's probably right.
In your in both your evidence and your summary, when it comes to rural character, which we've already talked to Mr. Robertson about, you use the words, and I think you repeated them again in your summary, not significantly endanger the rural landscape, character of the landscape, can sit comfortably or able to absorb. So does not significantly endanger mean the same as maintain?
Yes, essentially it does. It means it won't degrade.
Or not significantly degrade.
Well, I mean, maybe that was an unfortunate choice, but I guess I'm saying the landscape in which the site sits won't be degraded by the presence of this zone.
So do you mean that rather than not significantly degrade?
Yes.
Really? Yeah. So you're because you don't actually say that the landscape will be the rural character of the landscape within which the site sits will be maintained. But is that your evidence?
Yes.
I won't ask you about remote again, because I think we've already had someone tell us it's very close to three parks, so we might not go down there. And anyway, you've given us your opinion on remote. And my main question is going to be about your response to Mr. Jones, and you've covered that in your summary, and thank you very much for liaising with him and me looking at that we really appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's helpful to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. No, that's all. Thank you.
Just a few. I noted in the. And thanks for the plan. It was like a coloured by number of one before, now it's been coloured, which is brilliant. But you did say that it's been formulated so that exposed parts of the site are free of built development. But if you look to the north, which is the escarpment around the Clutha, it does seem to be that the Fairway Visitor Accommodation, which is the yellow AA1, does seem to brush the top of that escarpment.
Yes, in a certain point there over on the western boundary, there is a blob of it that goes up almost to the lip of the escarpment. If you look really carefully in the contours underneath there, you can see there's a sort of a rounded hill there.
Yes.
And really that yellow area has been configured to be on the part of that hill that slopes off to the west, slopes down to the
into
west.
Into the site.
Into the site and towards the site that's immediately to the west of the site. So, yes, it was felt that an area of that activity area can sit there without being significantly exposed to views to the north.
So it's a deliberate... Because I know that I read the resource consent decision that was for the rural residential lifestyle, and there was quite a lot of conversation about that escarpment from... the likes of Mr. Howarth and about keeping everything back, and I'm assuming that's why there is that open space buffer running up there.
Yeah, well, that's right, and in fact, that existing resource consent places a number of houses in what is labelled here as high sensitivity area. It places a number of houses almost at the lip of that escarpment, looking north. So, the design of this has removed development from that particular area, if you like.
And that would be and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth because you're not the developer, but that would be, this isn't Mr. Ferguson's house looking out over the river or anything.
Well, look, I don't know, but that particular little yellow area of Fairway Visitor Accommodation Activity Area, is lesser than what's provided for under the existing resource consent.
Thank you. Thank you. And just on from the discussion that we're talking about, because I'm interested in your opinion as a landscape architect, and I've read your evidence, and it quite equivocally states that you believe that there's logic in this development being located on this site.
You mean equivocally or unequivocally?
How did I say say, unequivocally. Yeah, I mean, that you support the fact that there's logic in this development taking place on this site.
In this location, yes.
And would it be fair to say then that there would be greater logic, potentially, in it being on this site in an RDZ?
On this site, sorry?
Taking place under the auspices of a rural visitor zone.
Well, that might be more for the planners, but yes, I'm from my perspective, I'm completely comfortable with that. Yes, provided the provisions do what they're supposed to do, I don't really mind what the zone's called.
So, and taking that a step further, from your perspective as a landscape architect, there would possibly be even greater logic if it was a resort zone.
Well, like I say, as far as my expertise goes in thinking about the effects of it on the landscape, the name of the zone really makes no difference. It's what takes are provided for, and that's what I've assessed.
Yeah, thank you.
But don't look at the landscape-related objectives and policies of the zone that's being sought, albeit that they are at a more detailed level than the strategic ones.
Well, other than to satisfy myself that the zoning's not going to provide for anything that I don't agree with.
So whether the site's remote or discreet or reasonably difficult to see,
generally
and all those sort of generally
invisible,
small scale, low density, da da da, as long as you're happy with what's being done in that landscape, it doesn't really matter to you what the policies of that zone say.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Espy, returning to this diagram, studying the point that the commercial plant was making. In the light of your recognition or acceptance of Mr. Jones' evidence, I can understand the sort of that the area between the two shelter belts is entirely in the identified medium. And there's a substantial, there's a material chunk on the western side of the, get my colours right, the high density area, as you say, which is now would now be a fully discretionary activity. But look, going back to that north area, the yellow area, you actually have quite small areas. There's right on the western boundary is a small triangle, and there's like a sliver at the other end of that. In terms of landscape planning, should they be eased off? Should they follow the identified boundary of the low sensitivity area rather than have those tiny slivers? I suspect would be more trouble than they were worth from a consenting point of view if they took the whole thing into discretionary.
Sorry, I'm not following. Which
well,
talking, yeah.
Yeah, this, would, well, this one's actually a high sensitivity. So there's
oh, I see.
There's one at either end.
Sorry,
there's
I see.
It's just a minor impingement, the yellow area under the high sensitivity area.
Yes, I would agree. It would be better to slightly reconfigure that such that they're not there. Yep.
Suggest like having got you on the fly like that, can I suggest that you reflect on that? And if that's your view, can you give us another copy of this plan with that change?
Yes.
not all for me, thank you.
That's all for us. Thank you once again, Mr. Espy. I will keep asking you whether that's the last time.
No, I think I'm on Tuesday.
Next week?
Next week, yes.
Ah, once more with Healing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're now on to the planning evidence. And we've got Mr. Curley and Mr. Edgar. And I wonder if we bring both of them up at the same time so that where there are questions that overlap their evidence, they can be dealt with.
Well, that would save us asking them. I'm thinking that we're looking good for time. We might just take a break and have a drink.
Yes.
So we'll be back at half past two. Thank you.